This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 350.
This podcast is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the ultimate daily all-in-one health drink with 75 proven vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients. And right now, Athletic Greens is offering our audience a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. Simply visit athleticgreens.com/MTA to get your free year supply of vitamin D and five free travel packs.
This podcast is also brought to you by Beam, the makers of Dream Powder, a tasty nighttime cocoa drink with CBD to help you get more restful sleep. Just visit beamtlc.com and use the code MTA for 15% off. That's beamtlc.com. And with the code MTA, you'll get 15% off your next order. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with Michael Crawley, author of the book Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. As an anthropologist and competitive runner, Dr. Crawley lived and trained in Ethiopia for 15 months to learn their secrets. We know you're going to enjoy this conversation. And just a reminder, you can get all of our back podcast episodes, training plans, and more, all the good stuff inside the academy. Learn how to become a member when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, squeezing in a quick episode before you get on a plane tomorrow to go fly to your marathon. Hope you're feeling well rested. Hope nothing is interfering with your condition, as we're going to hear about on the podcast today. All right, so before we jump into our conversation with Michael Crawley, let's give some shout-outs. What's going on out there in MTA land, as we call it?
This note comes from Heidi. She says, I smashed it. 6 minutes off my previous half PR for a time of 2 hours, 12 minutes, and 46 seconds. Thanks, MTA, for the training plan. I pretty much followed it to a T, and it paid off. Having the paces in the plan really makes a difference. I wouldn't push myself hard enough otherwise. I got to set a new goal now.
Love it. Well done.
And we'd like to say congratulations to Jen, who is a client of MTA Coach Henry. She ran the Derby Half Marathon in Louisville. Coach Henry said that throughout her training, she worked hard, nailed her workouts, and persevered through some challenges. And she ran her best half in a few years and had a negative split. But she also wrote this to Coach Henry, which he was really pleased to hear. She said, I felt pretty strong and had very positive self-talk the whole way. There was another woman really suffering in the last mile, and I encouraged her and brought her in with me. It felt great to have enough mental energy for both of us.
Hey, that is good. When you are able to have your cup overflowing, as they say, and be able to encourage other people. I've certainly been in plenty of races where people need encouragement.
That's right. And sometimes you're in the position where you need the encouragement, but it's great to be in the position where you can encourage someone else to finish strong.
Angie, do you remember one year you're at the Marine Corps Marathon and some guy was like moaning and groaning and you're like, you can do it. Come on, only five more miles. And he says, no, I can't.
That was at the Wine Glass Marathon in Corning, New York. Yeah, okay. I remember it vividly. Just this guy sounded like he was in absolute agony, just moaning and groaning and very vocal negative self-talk. Hmm. And so, you know, I kind of came up alongside him, said, you know, you're doing great. You only have whatever the distance was, you know, just keep moving forward. You can do it. He's like, yeah, no, I can't. I'm like, yes, you can. He's like, no, I can't. I'm like, all right, well.
Good luck.
I can't help you anymore. I'm sorry.
Should have tried reverse psychology.
Well, I was trying to PR, so I didn't really want to like waste a lot of time in this impromptu counseling session, but I hope he finished. We got this nice note from Patty. She says, Yahoo, yesterday I PR'd and Boston qualified at the Glass City Marathon in Toledo, Ohio. I'm so grateful that I chose to train for this marathon using one of Angie's training plans. I stuck to the plan and it absolutely paid off. I'm a 51-year-old runner who finally reached a huge running goal of mine. I wouldn't be where I am today without MTA. And she says, thank you, thank you.
Wow. Well, thank you for those nice words. So glad the plan worked out and you PR'd and BQ'd. You're going to be celebrating that for the rest of your life.
That is so exciting. I remember that feeling.
I don't.
So you don't follow my training plans.
I have PR'd, but I've never BQ'd. But I'm sure it must feel amazing.
And this note comes from Jill. She's an Academy member. She says, bucket list goal completed. My first, perhaps only 100 miler done. Thanks to everyone in this group for helping me to stay motivated and focused. For others like me who embrace the pain of distance running but are too slow to meet most cutoff times for runs of this distance, consider time-based runs. I signed up for the 72-hour challenge at the Jackpot Ultra, and it was a fantastic decision. I felt motivated throughout but not pressured.
Wow, 100 miles. Congrats, Jill, on completing that epic distance. We actually got to meet her in person, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, she's just a go-getter and just so in awe of what she was able to accomplish.
And congrats to all you out there trying to accomplish big things in your running, keeping it real. I know this interview will be interesting. We are talking with a social anthropologist, Dr. Michael Crowley, who is assistant professor at the University of Durham in the UK. His book is called Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. He actually went and lived and trained for 15 months in Ethiopia. It was part of his doctoral work. He wrote a dissertation later about some of the stuff that you're going to hear about. And I guess the book is more of like a popular level layman's look at, you know, his time there.
Yeah, it was just a fantastic look inside Ethiopia and the running culture there. I found it especially interesting because two of our nieces are from Ethiopia. So it was just a really neat look into the country. I think he did a great job as an anthropologist of building relationships and really detailing what his life was like there.
And some of the training methods and philosophies that he talks about, I think will be relatable and can be applied to our own running. So I should also mention that Michael is an accomplished runner himself. He's run a 220 marathon. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Michael Crowley. Well on my way. Okay, we're on the podcast now with Michael Crowley from the UK, author of the book Out of Thin Air. Michael, great to have you on the MTA podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm curious how you got started as a runner, because without you being a runner in the first place, I'm sure this whole book wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, sure. I started running competitively when I was about 14, I think. In the same way that a lot of people do, I guess. I was playing a lot of football and other sports, and then got into running and realized I was quite good at it. So I was very lucky, actually. I lived three doors down from a guy who happened to have run a 2:14 marathon back in the 80s. He used to run for Gateshead Harriers, which is quite a famous club in the UK. And so he had all these books about running and all these kind of stories about people like Charlie Spedding, who was an Olympic medalist from the UK. And so he kind of got me hooked on sort of the culture of running, I suppose, with the stories from Gateshead Harriers. And I suppose the interest in the kind of culture of running that I got from talking to him then transferred, and I started to get curious about what was going on in Kenya and Ethiopia and other countries, and kind of what made runners over there tick, what kind of motivated them and stuff like that.
So you come from an anthropological background. You know, what were you hoping to learn by living and training in Ethiopia for, I think it was 15 months, you said in the book?
Yeah, I suppose I was mainly just trying to kind of understand what the world looks like to somebody who's trying to change their lives through running. That's kind of how most Ethiopian runners talk about it, that they're trying to change their lives by making money and being able to support their family and things like that. So the way that I wanted to understand that was to kind of live the lifestyle that they live, try as far as possible to kind of follow what they did, live with them, eat meals with them, sort of follow the same rhythms of kind of recovery that they follow, and really try to understand what the world looks like from their point of view, I guess.
So give us an idea of how a winning amount of money at a marathon, even if you don't get first place, you know, if you get second, or sometimes there's prize money all the way back further, but how does that change their life when they bring that money home?
Well, hugely. Even, you know, $20,000, something like that, would allow somebody to build a house and several sort of, you know, buildings that could house like a barber shop and a shop, you know, like a convenience store or something like that. So that's what they tend to do when they first win money. They build something like that back in their hometown. And that allows them to sort of rent out those properties, which is basically like a kind of insurance policy after they've retired from running. They'll have something that is able to support them after that. So that's kind of what people are aiming to do, is set themselves up financially from kind of 5 years of running.
Wow. Wow.
I think you did a fantastic job in the book of just putting people in the country through your own experience. I mean, you learned Amharic, you know, the main language there. Trained
no easy task, I'm sure.
You ate with them. What was it like going from basically running at sea level to running at that kind of altitude? And I mean, explain this, the kind of training conditions with the group that you were running with.
Sure. Yeah. It was, it was tough to begin with. It takes like a good week and a half to get even a little bit used to the altitude. But I found it was very easy to kind of assimilate into a group in Ethiopia because, you know, basically they believe very strongly that you have to train with other people in order to get better. So the first kind of morning that I went out for a run, I sort of walked just into the forest above where I was living and started jogging, and somebody came and literally just grabbed me. And sort of brought me into a group of athletes.
They were trying to save you from the hyenas, right?
Well, yeah. So that's part of it. But then also just like this idea that if you want to be an athlete, you have to surround yourself with other people. So they said that training on your own is good for staying healthy. But if you want to sort of transform yourself and become a better runner, you've got to be with other people all the time. So that, I guess, kind of made it easier, but also harder in some ways because I was then expected to try and keep up with people who were obviously quite a lot better athletes than I am. And I was able, I mean, for the most part, for the kind of forest running, which is a lot of what they do is more kind of trail running, weaving in and out of eucalyptus forest. A lot of that running is actually very slow, which is great because it meant that I was able to keep up and actually learn from kind of following their footsteps, I suppose.
When they do that, when they run through the forest, they sort of zigzag and kind of go randomly, which they believe helps with what exactly?
So I think it's sort of mainly to as a way of kind of recovering from harder training. So we did basically three really tough runs in a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings. And then apart from that, most of the other running was in forest, which from my perspective, when I first arrived, was not a particularly easy place to run. So kind of very hilly, very tightly packed trees, lots of kind of tree roots and rocks and things like that on the ground. And yeah, as you said, we kind of weaved in and out of the trees and zigzagged backwards and forwards. And I think that was part of it was to kind of build agility and things, but it was also to ensure that they were running nice and slowly on the easy days. So they believe very strongly that you have, you know, you've got your three hard sessions and then the rest of your running should be quite regenerative, quite easy, quite varied in terms of the surface and things like that. So they would deliberately run in places that were difficult to run in order to make sure they went slowly and didn't do too much. That was the logic behind that, I think.
I was really surprised how little road running they do. I mean, they try to stay away from asphalt as much as possible. Did you have any other similar misconceptions about what it would be like when you went over there?
Yeah, I didn't realize that the road thing would be so, they'd be so strict about that, but it was like, yeah, we train on the road on a Friday morning and that's it. You want to avoid the road at all costs otherwise. And that was because they thought the impact was too much of running on roads and that you needed to kind of lessen that. I didn't expect the easy running to be quite so slow sometimes. I mean, these are guys who can run 3 minutes per kilometer in a race or, you know, 4:40 something for a mile over a marathon, but they're often running 10-minute miles in the forest. So that's just a huge difference to, I think a lot of people would just do most of their runs at pretty much the same speed. So that kind of range of speeds was quite different. And then I think the main thing is just this idea that you have to be in the group all the time. That was kind of, you know, so important that this idea that they could kind of share their energy with other people and kind of harness the energy of others. And that was why it was so important to always be in a group.
What is that like to run in a group? I mean, I know that reading the chapters when you're describing running with these amazing athletes, I just got exhausted just reading. I wasn't even running. I was sitting in a chair. It sounds like you guys a lot of times were doing single file and they kind of snap their fingers if they wanted to draw your attention to a route or a turn or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the forest, it was usually one person would be kind of leading. Mm-hmm. And you had all these, rather than it being kind of one trail through the middle of the forest, like you'd expect a lot of the time, it was like a series of just crisscrossing paths that went everywhere. And those paths have basically been created by runners as they'd kind of just been doing, you know, thousands of kilometers in the forest. And so whoever was leading would just kind of make it up as they went along. and you'd be kind of just reacting to them and trying to kind of, you'd have to constantly be kind of concentrating and working out where they were going to go, essentially. But that kind of made it in many ways more interesting. Like it made the run feel a little bit more like an adventure or a bit more creative than just like going for a run down a road. And then some of the runs, like we ran in some just stunning places, you know, like just rolling hills with farmland on either side. And those runs where we got into a rhythm, because they run a lot of the time, they'd be kind of two single file lines and people are actually running in time with each other. Mm-hmm. So they synchronize their footsteps. So if you actually get into that rhythm, it's almost like meditative. It kind of gets you into this sort of state of just sort of zen exhaustion or something. I don't know. But it feels really nice when you get it right. I mean, for me, it was like I could keep up with that kind of run for maybe 10K or something. And then I would normally get in the bus that was luckily would follow the runners. But yeah, I can see why they do that group running when you actually do it and get into that rhythm. It feels great.
So did you run specifically with the guys or did you get to go out on some female runs too?
So basically what I decided to do was write an ethnographic study for my PhD that was mainly about male runners. Mm-hmm. Just because a lot of the female runners are from quite rural areas, then quite shy, and it felt like I was making them uncomfortable asking them loads of questions and stuff. So I was like, right, I'm going to focus on the guys. But then the problem was, obviously, these guys are like the slowest people, maybe 2:12 for a marathon. My PB is about 2:20. So it's like, that's quite a gulf. So what would normally happen is I would start off with the guys and then I'd end up in kind of no man's land between the two groups. So I think actually in terms of if I'd been just purely there as an athlete, the best thing for me to do would have been to train with the women's group because they were much more at my level, especially at the altitude and things.
So what kind of esprit de corps exists among the group? Is there trash talk among the athletes? Are they pretty positive toward each other or what's that like?
They're like incredibly positive and very much like constantly talking about the importance of teamwork and, you know, the person who's leading the run, taking responsibility for the group, making sure they keep the pace right and all that kind of thing. I did feel sometimes that constantly talking about the importance of the team and how great everything was and how everyone was such good friends there was kind of an underlying tension sometimes because, you know, the reality is that these guys do have to race each other sooner or later and they do have to compete to a certain extent because, you know, whoever's running best in training is usually the one who's going to get selected to go and race abroad somewhere and get a chance to make money. So the way that people talked was always very, like, very much about the importance of the group and being friends and kind of, yeah, caring for each other, I suppose.
Tell us about the concept of condition that they have.
Yeah, sure. So that was what was interesting was that in Amharic, they would use the English word condition when they talked about sort of fitness, I suppose. That was kind of what I thought is like the best translation would be. But I felt like it was actually when they talked about it, it meant more than just what we would refer to when we said physical condition. So it kind of meant how confident they were about going to a race. It meant things like, you know, their spiritual condition. Sometimes they would talk about kind of, you know, relationships with God and things like that quite a lot. And it also, I think, was very dependent on the environment around them. So they felt like a lot of the time when people talked about training, they didn't talk about kind of different training sessions that they needed to do. They talked about different places that they needed to go around the city in order to kind of build condition. So it was like to do with putting yourself in a good position in relation to the environment, basically. So they would think about, they had the mountain in the city, Mountain Toto, which is like, it goes up to about 3,300 meters above sea level. That's where they would go to run really slowly in the very thin air and just kind of build aerobic condition, I suppose. And then other days they would go somewhere much lower down that was really hot and they'd run like super quick. So I think, yeah, when they talked about condition, they were also talking about kind of the air conditions and the kind of environmental conditions as much as they were talking about their own bodies. So it's kind of a much, I think, slightly more complex idea of what condition is than perhaps our idea of what physical condition means.
There seemed to be a pretty deep spiritual component to a lot of their training that you just don't hear people talk about in the West. But you mentioned Mountain Toto. Is that sort of a sacred mountain for the runners?
I mean, it's seen as very important because of the very high altitude, but I feel like there's also a certain sense of like mystique that comes from the number of churches they have up there. It's got a lot of Orthodox churches. Actually, I mean, one thing that's interesting is that elite athletes in America as well. I feel like a lot of elite distance runners do talk about, like Ryan Hall, he used to come to Ethiopia pretty frequently, and Sarah, and Ryan said he used to like go to run on Intoto. He used to do a run where he ran from the bottom of the mountain to the top. And he said he did that because it made him feel close to God. So I think it's like, it's interesting that a lot of elite athletes seem to feel this like quite close relationship to God. But people did, they talked about it a lot. And it was a way that people tended to kind of rationalize difficulties in their career as well. So people would have this sense that God had a larger plan for them with their running. So if they had a bad race, they would normally, you know, not be too disappointed necessarily. They would just sort of say, well, you know, God didn't want it to happen for me today, but he's obviously got a plan for another time. This is a sign that I need to be patient and just keep going with my training, and sooner or later it'll pay off. So I think that, yeah, those the kind of religious beliefs that they had, I think, suited, as they were all about being patient and being humble and listening to the coach and just kind of getting on with things, basically. That was how that manifested itself. So yeah, compatible with being an elite distance runner, I think.
It sounds like it kind of goes along with the whole idea of condition, a very holistic concept, body, mind, soul, spirit. And I think something that kind of stands out with long distance runners is having to spend that much time running and training and pushing yourself. It does make a person more introspective just because you have that time to go within. So, you know, that's kind of one thing I think that you really pointed out well in the book.
Yeah, I think they did definitely see it as this holistic process that was, you know, it's not just that you're training 2 hours a day, it's that you kind of have to reorder all aspects of your life around running. So they would say, you know, you can't have a job and be an athlete. If you're a runner, that's what you're doing. It needs kind of full focus. They would talk about doing laps. Any kind of chore, they're like going into town to go shopping or anything like that, was referred to as doing laps. That was to be avoided at all costs. So if the like laps were fine as long as they were on a track, but otherwise it was like, if you're not running, you want to be resting as much as possible and kind of doing what you can to recover.
I hope you've enjoyed this conversation thus far. Quick break to thank two sponsors of the podcast. We really appreciate these companies. First of all, Beam. They're a CBD company that's making waves in the wellness industry. They're offering products that combine THC-free CBD with other high-quality ingredients. The company was founded by two ex-professional athletes. They make a product called Dream. And Angie, since you are a sleep zealot, tell us about Dream.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite products. It comes in a CBD capsule or a powder, and you can use it to get better, more restful sleep. It has compounds like magnesium and melatonin, and it just really helps your body wind down to get a deeper night's sleep. Plus, it tastes like a delicious, healthy hot cocoa, so there's no downside.
Who doesn't want to drink cocoa before you go to bed?
That's right. You can try Dream today with a special offer for MTA listeners. Visit beamtlc.com and use the promo code MTA for 15% off. That's beamtlc.com and use the code MTA to save 15% off your next order. And if you decide to opt into their subscription, you can get up to 35% off with code MTA.
And thanks also to Athletic Greens. There's 75 whole food sourced ingredients in Athletic Greens, and they're always iterating and making it better. I mean, even since they've been a sponsor, I think they've iterated 5 times. I don't know how it can get any better, but it keeps getting better.
That's right. This is something we've been taking for over 2 years. It is one of those things that I do not leave home without. Like, I've already got my little travel packs packed of Athletic Greens so I can take it every single morning, including marathon morning. And it's one of those things I can just depend on to help me cover my nutritional bases and to support my immune system as well. So it's one of those things that I recommend to all our friends and family members. And right now, Athletic Greens is doubling down on supporting your immune system. They're offering you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase when you go over to athleticgreens.com/MTA.
That's right. 1-year supply of vitamin D, 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to athleticgreens.com/MTA. So this is really fascinating. Well, see, another part of the book that just made me exhausted was all the early morning runs.
Yeah.
Seems like they would just go out of their way to build more discipline into themselves by doing harder things like running at 3 a.m. or taking cold showers when they got back from a run.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly because Ethiopia is like bang on the equator. So it gets light at 6 o'clock every morning and it's nice and cool and really, really good for running for a couple of hours, and then it starts to get quite hot. So they would try to get out in the like that kind of optimal running time, I suppose, of the day. But that meant also that if we were going somewhere on the team bus, they would want to get there by six. So we'd have to get up at like 4:30, get picked up on the bus at 4:45, and then drive for an hour to get somewhere. And then we'd always get stuck in traffic on the way back into Addis. So sometimes to go to training, we'd be out for sort of before 5 o'clock until about 12 o'clock midday. And we'd often not eat anything for that entire time either. So you'd just come back and be absolutely like, well, I'd just be so tired. and then we'd, you'd usually sleep a little bit in the afternoon and then train again about 4 o'clock. But then, as you said, yeah, there would be some occasions when we would do things that just, to me, seemed completely crazy, like set an alarm clock for 2:30 in the morning to get up and go and run up and down a hill. And if you asked a sports scientist about that, they'd say, well, you probably don't want to be interrupting your sleep halfway through to go and do hill reps. But the reason they did that was like partially because the hill was on the road and it was a way of avoiding any traffic. But it was partially, I think, just to, you know, yeah, as you say, like building an extra bit of discipline or an extra level of hardship that I think was quite important in terms of kind of building a kind of psychological strength, I suppose. So I write a lot in the book about this idea of dangerousness that they try to cultivate. And I think things like getting up at 2 a.m. to go and run up and down a hill, it's maybe not doing that as much for you physiologically as it's doing for you in terms of your psychology and your ability to then go and stand on the start line of a race and think, I got up at 2 a.m. to go and run up and down that hill. There's probably not anyone else here who's done that sort of thing. So it's a way of feeling like you're doing more than other people and things as well.
Speaking to this idea of dangerousness, I think I remember reading about a speed work session. Maybe they're at the track or somewhere, and one guy was just really pushing it hard, like blistering pace. Everyone was getting exhausted. Maybe he was up at elevation, and the guy said, I'm a very dangerous man.
That's, I mean, people used to say that. I think I also quote Bahanu saying that when we went out for a run in Gondar, like right up in the north of Ethiopia at a training camp, and it was freezing. It was like 1 degree, and we'd been running up on a mountainside in the mist. You couldn't really see, you know, more than a couple of feet in front of you. And we got back and everyone was freezing. And he just like basically stripped down to a pair of shorts and then had like a cold shower outside. and that is when he was like, yeah, I was like, what are you doing? And he was like, oh, I'm fine. I'm a dangerous man. it's like just sort of finding ways of getting that feeling of kind of power, I suppose. I didn't used to generally indulge in the cold showers that much.
No, I wouldn't either.
Yeah, that would be tough.
So for maybe some of our listeners who haven't heard of the great Ethiopian runners, past and present, can you kind of give us a little overview? Let's start with Abibi Bakila. Who was he?
So he was basically one of the first runners to emerge from Ethiopia, and he won the Rome Olympic Marathon in 1960. So basically Haile Selassie, who used to be the emperor of Ethiopia, hired a Swedish army major to come and train his imperial bodyguard, which included Abibi Bakila. And this guy, Onni Niskanen, he just thought, well, you know, these guys look like they might be quite good runners. And he'd come from Scandinavia, where at that time the runners were very good. And he started basically coaching Abibi, who then went on to win Rome Olympic Marathon barefoot, which was significant at the time because Mussolini had invaded Ethiopia in the 30s. And so being able to go to Italy and then win the marathon, you know, barefoot in front of all these Italian soldiers was like, you know, really significant in terms of kind of Ethiopian national pride, I guess. And so from that point onwards, people were like, okay, running's this way of proving ourselves as a nation and that kind of thing. So he kind of started the tradition of running. And then, so there were a few figures, Miritz Yifter, who was called Yifter the Shifter later. And then more recently, I suppose, the people that listeners might have heard of would be kind of Haile Gebrselassie, Kenenisa Bekele, people like that.
Yeah. So let's talk about fueling. They're also very adamant about what you should eat.
What you shouldn't eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, people had a very, very, good diet, but nothing kind of really unusual, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, they ate a lot of injera, which is a traditional kind of pancake style bread in Ethiopia, which is made of teff grain, which is very high in iron. and pretty high in protein. So it's like, I think that's kind of become fairly mainstream now as a superfood. So that's something that they ate a lot of. They didn't eat anything processed, really. And that was something that I realized that when I went to Bokoji, which is where Kenny Sabakeli is from, and a place where I kind of a lot of athletes spent their formative years, people would say that they'd never eaten anything that was grown sort of further away than they could see.
Wow.
So they would, you know, people grew up basically on farms. So they're all eating pretty organic, very locally grown food. And then when people moved to the city, they would start to eat kind of pasta and rice and things like that a lot more. But yeah, no kind of big secrets in terms of the nutrition, I don't think. One thing that was interesting was that people didn't tend to, you know, often in the West, we talk about hitting a kind of 20-minute window after exercise to eat something in order to recover quickly. Because of these long bus journeys that I was telling you about, people didn't tend to manage to do that pretty much ever. And there didn't seem to be much anxiety around that. So
you didn't see the runners, they weren't like quaffing gels and sports drinks and recovery drinks?
Sometimes. I mean, the managers of the athletes would often send that stuff over sometimes. But it would only be the top athletes that had access to that kind of thing. It takes a while to get used to that. So they would try to practice with the gels and energy drinks before a race, because it was just, I think people find it quite hard to digest that stuff sometimes. But for the most part, the thing that people used was something called beso, which is basically like roasted and ground barley that basically ground into a powder, and you would mix that with water and dissolve it into basically a carbohydrate drink that is something that isn't just for runners. It's something that people drink a lot of in the fields when they're working in kind of agricultural areas and things like that as well. So that kind of roasted barley with some honey in it would be the sort of natural Ethiopian version of an energy drink.
How does it taste?
It's really good, actually. Yeah, I brought those back with me. So yeah, it's really nice. It's kind of thick and gloopy and sweet. Okay. But it does give you a lot of energy. Like, you drink it and you can feel the energy that it gives you.
Hey, maybe there's a market for it.
That's right.
That's interesting. So you mentioned how these athletes, they just train full time. How do they support themselves for the most part?
Yeah, so that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize about Ethiopia and Kenya. We kind of think of it as, yeah, we kind of imagine people running to and from school barefoot and just kind of naturally emerging as champion athletes. But there's this real strong kind of institutional support for athletics in Ethiopia. So you've got lots of training camps, like the one I described before, sort of dotted around in Oromia and Amhara regions for teenagers. And those are fully paid for by the government. So they have kind of dormitories and things that people sleep in. And then in Addis, there's a whole load of running clubs that are sponsored basically by organizations that are linked to the state. So the bank or the electricity corporation and companies like that.
Even the prison, right? Isn't there a running club named after the prison?
Yeah. So there's the National Prison Club, and then there's regional prison clubs as well from Amhara region and places. So and then police forces, all the regional police forces have an athletics club as well. But they really support people with a salary, you know, not a big salary, but enough to live on to cover your expenses while you're training. So yeah, I used to run a lot with the people from the Electric Corporation Club, because some of them also worked with the manager that I knew. And they could go to the canteen of the electricity corporation for lunch if they wanted. So we would sometimes on the way back from training pop in with all these into this, you know, big canteen with all the people who worked for the electric corporation to have lunch. And I think it's like, yeah, there's hundreds of athletes essentially who are funded to run full time in Ethiopia. So it's a lot more support than most governments give to any athlete, I think.
Are there any expectations if the runner makes it and wins money to give back to the club that they came from, or how does that work?
Sometimes informally with coaches and things, yeah. Sometimes, I mean, I had conversations with some people from rural training camps who had, you know, been working with people who'd gone on to make, you know, millions of dollars, and they would sometimes be a little bit upset at the fact that the runners had never come back and kind of helped them out. So, but I think it does happen sometimes. I mean, Kenenisa Bekele and Tirunesh Dibaba's coach lived in Bokoji, where I spent quite a bit of time, and they had gone back and built him a house and things like that. So they do tend to support people, and Haile Gebrselassie went on to become president of the Ethiopian Athletics Federation and things like that. Kenenisa Bekele's built a track. So they do, yeah, they find ways of giving back.
There are a lot of interesting people in the book that you interviewed, that you stayed with, that you talked about. Would you say that there's a main character in the book, other than the author? Is there a, who would be a main character that maybe we could tell people about? And
I think I write quite a lot about a runner called Faso, who was not the best runner in the group by any means. And he'd actually only started pretty recently when I arrived in Addis. But he just had an amazing attitude of just would never admit to being tired, was always just like positive about his running. And he had some amazing stories from when he was growing up of kind of being having to go and try to get cattle back that had been stolen by some neighboring people and ending up getting tied to a tree and left overnight and things like that.
Wow.
And like, yeah, stuff that happened to him in his youth that I think made him just feel like running 35K in the morning was just like, it was a piece of cake, really, basically. So yeah, he was a pretty amazing guy.
And how old was he at the time?
At the time he was early 20s. It's sometimes a bit difficult to completely pinpoint exactly how old people are. But yeah, he would have been about early 20s. And then I suppose one person who sort of came into the group as somebody who had never run abroad before and has now gone on to being extremely good is Jamal Yima, who, he ran his first race abroad in Nigeria at the African 10,000 meter championships shortly after I arrived in Ethiopia. And he's now the Ethiopian record holder for the half marathon. He's run 58:33 for a half.
Wow.
So it was fascinating to see his sort of trajectory from somebody who had never left Ethiopia before to being at that kind of level.
Did you have a premonition that he would achieve that greatness back when you met him?
There was a sense that, I mean, not so much that I did, but the sub-agent of the group who was kind of in charge of the main, of kind of deciding who went to races and of organizing training and all that kind of stuff, he knew somehow that this guy was going to be amazing. I suppose that's his job to kind of have a sense for these things. But I think it was when he came back from running in the African Championships and he made a few thousand dollars there. And it was the fact that he just put the money in his bank account and said he wasn't going to look at it. He was just going to pretend it didn't exist because he didn't want to get distracted by things. And that was to Haile, the sub-agent, he just thought, well, this guy's obviously got, you know, he's got the focus and the kind of ability to switch the unimportant things off, I suppose, that that you need in order to get to the top. And he was right.
Yeah, and there was a word for that, right? About getting distracted by those unimportant things.
Most of the conversations me and Haile had were in English because his English was very good. But he used the phrase hodgepodge things, which I thought was quite a nice turn of phrase in English.
That's a very British thing to say, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But by that, he meant kind of things like going on Facebook or going and sitting in cafes and going to play pool and in kind of these pool houses that they have or going to watch football and things like that. Anything that was a distraction was a hodgepodge thing. Highly.
That describes my whole day.
I know, exactly.
So it sounds like some of these guys, maybe we can imagine they live a pretty Spartan life on purpose.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, even someone like Eliud Kipchoge in Kenya, he's a multi-millionaire now, and he has a big nice house with his family and things. But he still goes to the same training camp that he's always trained at when he's building up to a race. He still is one of the people who pulls water up from the well when they need water. He still sort of gets involved with cleaning shoes and cleaning clothes and things like that. And I suppose you've kind of got to keep that simplicity in terms of the approach to training and that kind of, if you can stay humble like that, I think it's what's helped him to stay so good for like 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, there are athletes like in any sport who, if they've never had any money and then they suddenly win $50,000, which is a huge amount in Ethiopia, they go off the rails because they just, it's hard to cope with that, I think, in some ways. But the people who succeed are the ones who are able to sort of compartmentalize and sort of know when it's time to train.
So what do they think of the Kenyan runners? Are they like the direct competitors?
Yeah. I mean, that's the main, I don't know what they think. I mean, there's a respect, I suppose,
okay,
for the Kenyans. I think they, like, the Ethiopians sometimes have a reputation for kind of just not doing much in races and sort of following the Kenyan lead group and then kind of sprinting incredibly fast in the last 100 meters to win races. so I suppose they're both aware of each other's tactics to an extent. But there's also a sense, I think, in Ethiopia that there's kind of more Kenyans. There's more people training at a high level in Kenya than in Ethiopia. So they kind of feel slight sense of being the underdog in some sense as well.
So do you keep track of, stay in touch with any of the people that you got to know while you were in Ethiopia?
Yeah, I'm still in touch with a lot of people. So Haile, the sub-agent I was telling you about, his wife, Kameshi, who's also mentioned in the book, is about to have a baby next week. That's really exciting. That's what the silver lining from COVID for me is, that, you know, she's won 3 or 4 marathons in her career. She's a very, very good athlete. And they realized that there was a gap in time now with no races.
Yes.
They could have a baby. So that's really nice. Jamal will be coming over for Antrim half marathon in Ireland in August. So hopefully you get down to see him down there. And I try to, you know, when athletes come to Europe or come to the UK, then I tend to go to the races and spend a bit of time with them, I think. So, yeah, I'm in touch with a lot of people.
So what do you think are some of the takeaways that those of us who are non-elite runners can glean from the Ethiopian running culture?
I think the idea that you need to sort of work on speed some of the time and then slowness at other times is probably one thing that, yeah, I think we often have a tendency to kind of just do all of our running at the same speed. And that was really not the case in Ethiopia. People were like, you know, in order to have the faster days, you have to really work at running slowly on the slower days. So that's one thing. I think this idea that you shouldn't run on the road too much is something that we can all learn from. I think when you think of an elite marathon runner, you imagine them running on the road, but actually most of the training that they do is essentially trail running. Mm-hmm. So just trying to get a bit more variety in that way. And then I suppose the main thing for me is this idea that you have to kind of work quite hard at making running interesting or as interesting as possible. And that's even true for somebody who is, you know, running at a very high level and is running to try to make money. They still are very invested in trying to make it a creative process, in trying to make running into something of an adventure, trying to make every run slightly different, trying to come up with ways of making things more interesting, like going out running in the middle of the night and things, and basically just being conscious of the fact that you need to try and make it as fun as possible, essentially. Finding playful ways of giving it meaning, I suppose, that's something that they seem to be very good at.
So the last chapter of the book is called Running is Life.
Yeah.
And that was a quotation by someone that you were interviewing in the book. What did he mean by that, running is life?
So that's, I think that's something that Haile said to me, who's the sub-agent I was telling you about. But I think he was probably quoting Haile Gebrselassie, who's the kind of probably the most successful Ethiopian runner of all time, who actually did, he gave me a quote to put on the front of the book, which includes running is life, I think. What does he mean by that? I think just that, I think, well, he's now a very successful businessman in Ethiopia, but he still runs absolutely every day. And I think he sees running and the kind of discipline it gives you and the sort of daily ritual of it as being in some sense a metaphor for life as well. So, yeah, it's Haile Gebrselassie, I think, said that.
We need to have him on the podcast.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, we appreciate you speaking with us today, Michael. We recommend everyone go out and get a copy of the book Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. And Michael, if people want to find you online and learn more about you, is there anywhere we can send them?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at mphcrawley. That'd be the best way to find out what's going on with me, I guess.
Perfect. All right. Well, thanks for speaking with us and have a great weekend.
Yeah, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Michael Crawley. Definitely check out the book, Out of Thin Air. Speaking of thin air, Angie, you're going to be going to elevation soon. So you're not quite going from sea level, but we're not too high up here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I think the marathon starts at 7,800 feet. So definitely more than I'm used to. Hopefully we'll be able to descend down into the valley.
You're
going to
run out of thin air.
I hope so.
Not out of air though, right? So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. We appreciate all of you. Definitely subscribe if you haven't officially subscribed to the podcast. Let's make it official. That way boom, the new episode will just pop up right there in your feed. And if there's any way we can help you, reach out. We've got a contact form on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. We're pretty quick on getting back to people, so shoot us an email. Until next time, always remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way, right on my way.